There's a way in which theological discussion and theological dialogue, I wouldn't say it's at a dead end, but it's a kind of a slough right now. And I think for the average Christian, it's all too technical, you know. I think that on a local level, where people experience ecumenism most is in social ecumenism, because they join up with others and in pursuing a particular goal. They coalesce around an issue and then work from there. And then they may have common prayer services and so on, and then begin to get an appreciation for another's faith. But it is where people on the ground come together, I think, and experience a real joy in being Christians and working together for the common good. I think, again, I think it'd be well if it were really appropriated by people in all the churches and Christian communities as something they're doing precisely as a commitment to social ecumenism. And as I said, I think one of the areas that could well be developed is that groups, mixed groups, could try to discern the signs of the times together. It doesn't mean that there aren't other roles and other responsibilities with discerning the signs of the times on the part of the magisterium and on the part of bishops' conferences and so on. But it seems to me that that's a part of the conciliar experience, the post-conciliar experience, that did develop for a time but needs really to be reappropriated.
You worked for a while, didn't you, on the Catholic Mennonite dialogue in particular?
I did.
Can you give us any examples of where perhaps this work together on social issues brought the communities closer together or brought a greater understanding?
We published our report in 2004 on the conclusion of the first round of the International Catholic Mennonite Dialogue. In 2006, the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity brought to Rome a delegation from the World Mennonite Conference, and it was, with a couple of exceptions, a different group than engaged in the dialogue. Now, what was astonishing about that meeting was that there was wide agreement by people who hadn't been a part of the earlier dialogue, and maybe because they were active church administrators and in some cases, pastors that had on the ground ecumenical experience. Discussion went very fast. And I wound up inadvertently, because the Mennonites didn't come up with their own theologian, being a theologian for both sides. And they both were happy with it. But, you know, there was agreement. We put together a statement for the World Council of Churches' Decade to Overcome Violence, which was an institutional statement by both sides on things that we could agree on. We hoped that the Decade to Overcome Violence would deal with. And the rapid agreement was just astonishing. And what was important there is that the Mennonites don't see themselves as a theologically sophisticated community. Actually, they have many sophisticated theologians, but the notion that the theologians have a less significant role than they would in the Catholic Church. So the people are practical, you know, and they wanted to see some common action. And they said, well, next stage, we got to do something practical. And this wasn't very practical, but it was, you know, nonetheless, an agreement on a practical agenda that we could present to the other churches together as kind of common positions that ought to be worked on.
You've also been particularly involved in the Middle East, haven't you, as an advisor to the American Catholic Bishops' Conference. Do you see, in some sense, the failure of any lasting peace agreement there? Do you see that somehow this reflects a failure on the part of the churches or faith communities even to be a more powerful advocate in that region?
Yes, I do. I think we never fail to engage sufficiently the grassroots to advocate on behalf of Christians in the Holy Land. And I think, you know, the formal organizations that are committed to support the church, they're supported financially, but they've not been able to get their act together on the justice and peace advocacy. The Knights of the Holy Sepulchre in the U.S. had for a few years, 3 or 4 years, an office for justice and peace, and it would advise the various lieutenancies about what issues were and what they could do, but it only lasted a short time. The lieutenancies, some lieutenancies never used it at all, and with the change in leadership in lieutenancies, the people felt it was too political, and so their support is financial and social and a union of prayer, but the active organization, the active advocacy is not what it should be. You know, that's a real disappointment. I mean, I worked very hard on that for a number of years, and the U.S. Church became very close both to the Church in the Holy Land, but also to the Holy See. We collaborated very closely. This coordination of bishops' conference meeting you attended last week in Jerusalem was a result of a coordination that the Vatican asked us to put together. I was leaving the job at the Bishops' Conference towards the end of 97. I left finally in 98. But when I came here to say goodbye, they said, no, you can't leave. You can't leave. You need to stay. And then finally it became, you need to stay in the ring, at least in the Middle East. So I stayed with the Bishops' Conference another 6 years as a counselor and did other things, but primarily continued to advise in the Middle East. I'm still engaged in various ways. But it's very hard to keep purchase. Politically, it's just incredibly tough territory. The U.S. Congress in particular, we call occupied territory. We could always do better whether you had a Republican or Democratic administration. The State Department and the National Security Council usually understood better the issues, and you could get some kind of agreement there in Congress. You could make very little headway.
That brings me on, in a sense, to my next question. What do you see as the most effective way of Christians for promoting justice and peace today? Is it advocacy, or are the other areas of solidarity and aid and development, where do you see as the most effective key to achieving results today?
I think things need to be in concert. I spoke yesterday about the Catholic Peace Building Network, but I think, and that's a combination of scholars, bishops' conferences, local groups, coming together to exchange experience and expertise and work on new projects. But those projects need outside advocacy to support them in different ways as well. As we learned in the Middle East, you can't make headway without a change in foreign policy. You need to have people engaged in foreign policy.
And does the church still have a voice there, do you think?
I think it can. My experience was generally the U.S. administrations were willing to assist us in secondary issues and not in primary issues. So, when we'd say, the issue of Jerusalem is very important and you need to see that this is kind of kept out of the divvying up of Jerusalem. There are other interests to be taken care of, their access to the Christians, the presence through citizenship and residency permits of Christians in the region and so on. Well, they'd prefer to deal with a particular issue that they could show political gain on. So at one point, you might get when the radical Muslim groups in the equivalent of Muslim Brotherhood in Israel was trying to build a mosque in Nazareth. And President Bush intervened at the request of Cardinal McCarrick quite directly in that. But it took a couple of years and a couple of interventions for the president to the prime minister to get that to happen. And in the end, it wasn't the prime minister, it was the courts to put an end to it in Israel. So you have to get very persistent attention to the issues to see that something can happen. But I'd say, I think that the Catholic Peace Building Network, which is based in the United States, is a real worldwide network of Catholics involved in peacemaking. Its bishops themselves have been mediators in situations, as their staff people. It's other independent Catholic groups that are working for peace or reconciliation in one way or another. It's experts in conflict resolution working with them. And I think it's a real model for what can be done. But I don't think they can work in a vacuum. You still need the advocacy as well. And that's kind of what we've tried to do over the past years.
What do you see as the largest challenge to that work today?
I think the real danger is the materialism of Western society, and therefore the lack of broader commitments and deeper commitments. There are young people who have them and pursue them, and although they do it in a more independent kind of way, I think. But there's a real need to engage the next generation in that kind of commitment. We've done a couple of stories now in America about parents who really tried to bring their children up as Christian, very much involved in their Catholic upbringing. And they write, they maintain their social justice concerns, but they're not committed to the church. So we need to have both. And social justice commitment shouldn't become a substitute for the church, but we need to cultivate that. And more broadly in society, we need to contribute to renewal through encouraging people's deeper aspirations, I think.